It's the Development Policy Centre podcast. In this episode, we bring you the keynote address from the 2015 Australasian Aid Conference by Professor Barbara McPaik of the Nossal Institute. Her presentation was on the topic of aid for health and its influence on health systems. Presentation slides are available at devpolicy.anu.edu.au.
It's now my pleasure to introduce Blair Excel. Blair is going to chair our first session, and he'll introduce Barbara McPaik, who's our keynote speaker for this morning. But yeah, for those of you who heard Tanya Plibersek lament the loss, or in fact the disappearance of skilled AusAid staff from the government, Blair is sort of living proof that's somewhat of an exaggeration. When I first joined AusAid myself, I think shortly thereafter, went and managed the Solomon Islands aid program for a while. He's also spent time managing the Indonesia program. He's currently the First Assistant Secretary for the Development Policy Division. So he plays a critical role in continuing to shape and influence the aid program and pursue the aid effectiveness agenda. So, Blair, we're very glad you can make time to be with us this morning, and I'll hand over to you. Please welcome Blair Excel.
Thank you very much, David. Good morning, everyone. Yes, I can also assure you that there are still a large number of WASAID people in the department still working extremely hard, and some of them are here, and thanks, colleagues, for coming along. Stephen's already stolen my kind of just reminding I am at a university free line that is guaranteed to grab attention, which is called free alcohol. So that's, you know, at least holds attention for 10 or 15 minutes is the theory, or that used to work anyway. But I am actually really pleased to be here this morning. The theme that we are discussing this morning resonates for me and indeed for DFAT extremely closely. To give you a sense of our department and how we work, just yesterday in what's called the Development Policy Committee, we were discussing and in fact debating DFAT's or the government's health sector strategy. What do we do? How do we go forward sitting under the aid policy? And issues and questions around health systems and health security were very much what we were talking about. So in terms of timing, this is fantastic. And I'm certainly looking forward to the presentation from Barbara. In my role also, I'm head of the Ebola Task Force in DFAT, and I'm co-chairing with a colleague from the Office of Health Protection in the Department of Health, our intergovernmental committee on Ebola. We're tremendously encouraged to see we have sort of turned the corner on certainly the number of cases in West Africa. That has significantly dropped. There are still blips, there are still little increases. I think about 3 weeks ago, for the first time since June last year, the total case number was under 100. About a week ago, it went back up to about 120 to 150. So there's still little blips going on, but I think that's partly a product of better monitoring, better tracing, and better systems across West Africa that we're able to, or certainly all the countries and all the partners were able to track those outbreaks better and respond much more quickly. So we're very encouraged with that work and the progression of what's happening there. There's still quite a bit to go. We're certainly not looking away from that part, and we have, of course, the Ebola Treatment Centre that is continuing its operations and doing very well in Sierra Leone. That, and the reason for mentioning that is, of course, that has critically focused attention on health systems and the link and the role that they have, and indeed not only over 1 or 2 years but over 10 or 20 years, and how they can help prepare not only for the broader population and issues but indeed for specific disease outbreaks. So that's been for us a really useful thing to point to say make sure we're thinking about this in our region, and the government has been thinking quite a bit about the implications for our region, not only specifically for the case of Ebola, but for other issues as well. So for all those reasons, this is fantastic. Our region, of course, faces a different set of challenges and circumstances than other parts of the world. We heard yesterday from Robin, countries with rapidly growing economies that are still struggling with poverty but have more resources than ever. What does that mean for Australia? How do we work with them? How does our assistance be best positioned and best placed? Equally, small island states with middle incomes, but limited capacity and human resources. And I think we heard Robin yesterday sort of position that slightly differently and suggest that many of these are aid dependent and will be for some time. And so how we work with them also into the future becomes critical. Many of these countries have weak health systems and as a result are vulnerable to emerging health threats, avian influenza, drug-resistant malaria, something we are spending a lot of time working on, and of course HIV, a long-term focus for us, or even old foes such as measles. And of course, it's not only the economic environments that's an issue here, but the political economy. Governance, accountability in each of those countries and in the global and regional institutions that guide our development assistance. The WHO annual meeting about 3 or 4 weeks ago had a critical discussion on WHO reform. The Secretary for Australia's Department of Health, Martin Bowles, attended that, and DFAT also had an officer, Ben David, who was part of that team to discuss those sort of issues. So looking with that, I'll sort of turn to this session, expecting that this will stimulate our thinking on what countries international development partners can do to support health systems and health security much more effectively. Stephen's already referred to Professor Barbara McPake. She's going to speak to these issues from 25 years of experience in this field of health policy and health systems research. Professor McPake is a health economist and the incoming director of the Nossal Institute for Global Health, a valued partner for DFAT. Before taking up her position at Nossal, Professor McPake was director of the Institute for International Health and Development at Queen Margaret University, Edinburgh. Thanks, Barbara. Welcome.
All right, good morning. Just like to start by thanking the organisers for inviting me to speak. It's a real pleasure. I'm going to start by showing some data about what some of the recent trends have been in health-related aid. And so I also just want to start with an apology to some of the people who were in the health panel yesterday. You saw some of this data and some of these pictures yesterday, but rest assured I'm going to say slightly different things about them. So keep your ears open anyway. Don't fall asleep when you see the same picture. Okay, so this is the overall level of health-related aid, and you can see the most obviously, first of all, it's been growing very rapidly from 1990 at the beginning of the series to 2011. And perhaps what also particularly stands out most obviously from that is that it's US government funding that has particularly driven that growth, with this bar here showing the growth in US government funding and the other bar showing the growth in other sources, which have, relatively speaking, been pretty stable. Although, I mean, if the US growth wasn't there, they might look like they'd grown a lot. So, if you break it down by how that aid is being channeled, we start to see some of the new channels that we talk a lot about, the Gavi, Global Fund, Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in the darker purple, and you can see the extent to which these new funds have increasingly been put through these new institutions. But I think just as important is to note that some of the old institutions remain important and have also grown. So, for example, the US government has put most of its resources continued through its own US government institutions, so they have grown most of all in relation to the channels of aid. The second fastest growth has been in NGOs, which is a very well-established traditional route for aid to flow through, but that has been growing dramatically. And only then do we get to the Global Fund, and then the UN has grown faster than has Gavi and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So we talk a lot about the new channels. The picture may not be quite as different as sometimes that dialogue suggests. And even WHO has grown a little, and I'm going to talk a fair bit about WHO, so it's worth just noting that at this stage. You can also very quickly just look at those same data in percentage terms, and that's when you can really see very clearly the sort of arrival of the Global Fund and the roles of different things. But I'll move rather quickly through that one. Here's the data that relate to health sector support funding. First of all, it's much, much lower than the others. That's not obvious from the graph, but the overall levels we were looking at were, let me just check before I say something, about 30 billion 2011 US dollars, so all these data are in real terms. What we're talking about in relation to health sector support funding is about 2.5 billion. So it's a small fraction of the total, and that's one of the things to note about it. But it has also been growing, and perhaps even more dramatically than other types of funding, with a huge growth in the early 2000s in resources directed to it. So if health sector support, which is the type of funding that most reflects investment in health systems, has a problem, it's probably not an absolute shortage of resources. It's probably something else. But the other thing to notice about this is that the funding sources that are being very important in the overall growth, the US is essentially not there at all by 2011. The funding sources that are accounting for investment in health sector support are primarily the other bilaterals, and that includes Australia in the other bilateral group in this graph. Oh, no, it doesn't. Some of the later ones do. This is other bilaterals outside the big six contributions. So that's interesting. And essentially what it says is that all the sources that are supporting health system strengthening are those that have been in relative decline, whereas if we compare it to funding for HIV, which is the next graph, we can see a much bigger percentage of the total funding, equally significant, probably more significant overall growth. But it's the funding sources that are the new and booming funding sources that are funding HIV, and the others are much less present in this. Then it's also, of course, interesting to look at what the situation is in the East Asia Pacific region that we're most concerned with. It's a small share of global aid funding. Not surprisingly, it's a relatively small region. The US is much less important, and again, I don't think that will come as a surprise to anybody. Australia is much more important, and other bilaterals are also very important. And what's interesting, because this is channels rather than sources, this graph, is the very, very large and growing importance of the Global Fund in this region in particular, more relatively important here than in the world as a whole. And then finally, just looking in this region, how have resources been distributed between the different uses of the resources? Perhaps what stands out most of all is this huge orange block. Things just called other are the most important types of health sector investment in this region. And that indicates that there's perhaps a rather different pattern. So things that the major categories that apply in other places appear not to always be the major categories in this region, and it's a different region, and that's not altogether surprising. What the region has in common is very little health sector support, the very pale blue there, growing HIV, and in relative terms, the growth in HIV spending has largely been at the expense of newborn maternal child health spending. And the last point about this is that NCDs are you can barely see them. They're the darker red here. And we'll come back to that point, what's happening with funding for NCDs. It's really shockingly low. Okay, this is another map that some people will recognise from yesterday. It comes from this report from the Chatham House, Mapping Global Health Architecture, to inform the future. It's used a slightly odd methodology. This is a point that Joel didn't make yesterday when he showed this. And the authors accept in it that's probably a bit of a misleading methodology, and that they'd probably do something a bit differently if they started again. And in particular, what it's done is it has prioritised US institutions in its map, even though the authors are Canadian. They've used a methodology that has ended up showing us a predominance of US institutions. What the map shows you is different institutions, their size is determined by the number of links they have to other institutions. So the biggest blobs have the most links to other institutions. And the paler and darker regions on the map show newer or older organisations. So looking at the map without even going into which institution is which, I'm sure it's too small to be able to see that, even if the abbreviations used were altogether understandable, and they're not. You really need to refer to the appendix at the back to figure out which ones are which. But you can see that some of the older actors in dark are still big and in the middle. So, for example, WHO is big and in the middle and dark. Similarly, the US government, MSF, the Population Council, Population Action International, old established organisations that are still big and central to the network. So again, let's not exaggerate the extent to which the aid architecture and the aid institutions have been rapidly changing. Nevertheless, there are a number of newer actors, the pale ones, that are also big and central, and the obvious one is the Global Fund, that's the TGF, that's one of the not altogether clear acronyms, I think, STP, Stop TB Partnership, and others are a sort of similar sort of size around those new public-private partnerships. FHI looks like it's a new organisation, central and big. It's been called new because it reinvented itself as FHI 360 in 2011, and it's been dated as if it came from then, but obviously if it was just new off the block as FHI 360 in 2011, I don't think it would be so large and central. I think its older existence as FHI was founded in 1971. Okay, so that's it for... Oh, no, sorry, one more look at this, because this shows you the different types of organisation in the network. The civil society organisations are in grey, so they look very dominant in the picture. The UN is in orange. The public-private partnerships are in that kind of funny olivey green, or actually it looks less olivey green on the screen than it does the bright green. And the government's in the pale green, or the sort of bluey green. And I think that the methodology has understated the importance of government organisations, because actually not a single non-American government organisation appears in the network, which to me is the real evidence that this is a pretty flawed methodology. The notion that no other government but the US is a global health actor does seem to strain belief a little. However, we can see the sort of makeup of the map from this point of view as well. So how has this changing aid environment affected attention to health systems and health system functioning? Well, first of all, it's fair to say, we might get the picture from some of the debate that all this focus on disease channeling of aid has completely marginalised and ruined health systems. And of course, the picture can't be as clear-cut as that. And many countries have succeeded in prioritising health system development, even in the context of the different emphasis of the major aid flows. So this book was published 3 or 4 years ago, an update of the Good Health at Low Cost from 25 years earlier than that. It updated us with stories about Bangladesh, Ethiopia, Kyrgyzstan, Tamil Nadu, looking at India from an individual state point of view, and Thailand, who have all made significant progress in their health systems over this period. So it would be unreasonable to say it's all been doom and gloom and catastrophe for health systems. The book also revisits the stories of China, Costa Rica, Kerala, and Sri Lanka that were the subjects of the original Good Health at Low Cost, and finds that things are still working reasonably well in those countries, although they've had their ups and downs, particularly China is recovering from serious decline since that original inclusion in the list. And we've probably also heard stories about the Rwandan health sector reforms and the success with those. In this region, the Solomon Islands is seen as a very successful case. Interesting that the Rwandan and the Solomon Islands cases are both tiny countries, and obviously it's a little bit easier to shake up a health system in a tiny country than it is in a country the size of China or India or even most of the ones in between. However, that is often in the face of donor priorities pushing countries in other directions. Cambodia is another country that you might put in the list of countries that have made dramatic improvements in their health systems over the period. But here's an example of why it's so difficult. The red bars, or the left-hand charts, again, it's too small to read, I'm sure, but the left-hand charts show you what Cambodia wanted in terms of the distribution of the aid that it was getting, and the right-hand charts show you what it got. And the red bar is particularly clear. It said it wanted a little bit of money for HIV AIDS control. It got a whole lot. It said it wanted the pink one, as it said it wanted a little money for other infectious disease control. And again, it got a whole lot. And its big green bar is what it wanted for primary health care strengthening. Now, it's a bit difficult to compare it directly because the bars on the other side have a number of different components of that. So there's basic health centres, there's health education, nutrition that would be included in the definition to primary health care, there's basic health infrastructure. So there's a number of bits, and it might be slightly better on that front than it initially looks. But the big picture is countries are not in control of asking donors for the funds that they want and getting it for the purposes they want. They are being given it for other purposes. And this might, to a certain extent, relate to what Robin was saying yesterday about rationales for aid about global public goods. It's maybe more obvious that infectious disease control is a global public good than it is that health system strengthening is a global public good. But back to that, because I think we're now clearer that health system strengthening probably is a global public good. And then a third element, a third element that makes this difficult is that there are quite a number of reports of people successfully strengthening health systems on the back of the funding that has been targeted at specific disease control. And clearly that's a theoretical possibility and an empirical question of the extent to which that has been successful overall versus that has been a weakness of the way that the disease-focused funds have flowed. But certainly there are examples in the literature from people recognising strengthening of health systems using disease-focused monies. However, there's also plenty else in the literature, and there's definitely a longer list, looking at reports of how some health systems functions have been unfunded, have been squeezed out by disease-focused investments, especially HIV-AIDS-related ones. Some research I was involved in a few years ago in Uganda was looking at how the drug supply system had been influenced by the flows of HIV drugs and the priority given to HIV drugs and the way that drugs for other conditions were getting held back in the pipeline, managed by less skilled health workers who couldn't get themselves into the HIV funding streams and generally undermined. So that's an example of a distorting effect of large new funding flows. More familiar, I think, are the stories of how Ministry of Health people are diverted into NGOs with disease-specific focuses because that's where the money is. And it's not, as we saw earlier, that there may be more money for health sector support, but if you've got other constraints that aren't just financial constraints and that money is still being drowned out by other resources, you can see how even with financial resources you can't necessarily resolve the health system issues. Now, the point about all this is that the debate stretches back a long way. We tend to, I think, in development to tackle debates as if they were all new and nobody'd ever thought of things yesterday. The Shadow Minister mentioned yesterday about the notion of aid effectiveness suddenly becoming a very exciting new idea. And the truth is that there are usually very few new ideas around, but lots of recycled ones. And this debate about channeling resources for disease control versus channeling them for health system support is very old. It's sometimes been called the vertical versus horizontal debate, which I don't like because it suggests a very singular health system and doesn't seem to me to recognise the plurality and the messiness of what really goes on the ground. But you know, we can use that terminology if people want, that's fine. So just looking at this figure, it shows you the sorts of things that have been happening in the World Health Organization since its origins, focused on disease control. And some of the World Health Organization's very early successes were clearly related to disease control. Obviously, the smallpox case in the 1950s in WHO, they were also expecting to be able to eradicate malaria, eradicate yaws, and eradicate a list of other conditions. Those objectives have shifted to elimination and control. Elimination being eradicating within a given regional area rather than and eradicating being reserved for global eradication of the smallpox nature. And that the argumentation about whether it's possible to eradicate or only eliminate or control goes back and forward with different diseases as different technologies become available, with some people wanting to put the notion of eradicating malaria and some other conditions back on the agenda. Then there's a bit of a gap. So we've got the announcement of smallpox eradication in 1980, and it's nearly 20 years later before there's a renewed enthusiasm for these kinds of disease-focused investments, with a whole clutch of them being invented. At WHO's instigation, I think, you know, not everybody seems to appreciate that it was Brundtland and David Nabarro, that, for example, that first got into motion the creation of the Global Fund. People have talked about it being a competitive mechanism, but it was certainly originally conceived of as a complementary mechanism and a mechanism that would help resolve some of WHO's difficulties of operation, about which I'll get back to later. And a very recent example is the London Declaration on 17 neglected tropical diseases that, again, is calling for a focused investment on those. Historically, this kind of free reign for disease-focused stuff at the beginning of WHO was in part related to the walking out of the UN of the Eastern Bloc countries in the 1950s. The Eastern Bloc countries had been far more from the early stages pushing for primary healthcare or basic health system strengthening. And when they left, it left the way clear for the disease-focused people to have the run of things. And they did until the Eastern Bloc countries came back at the end of the 1950s and started pushing the primary healthcare movement. And so this is what happens in the middle of that big gap between smallpox eradication and the new clutch of public-private partnership disease-focused mechanisms is the primary healthcare movement. And that's very much instigated by the return of the Eastern Bloc countries to the UN. It's no coincidence at all that the big primary healthcare conference was in Almaty in the USSR, now Almaty in Kazakhstan, of course. Nevertheless, despite it being a sort of USSR-driven agenda, what emerged from Almaty was very much Halfdan Mahler's, the director general of the WHO at the time's vision of what primary healthcare should be. And I think, you know, the role played by Halfdan Mahler is a very important one in the story. He was director general from, I think, 1973 to 1988. So really takes WHO from the immediate post-war era through to the modern era, and his imprint on the organisation, I think, is huge. That's something I'll come back to. Now, I think what perhaps is starting to emerge from that picture is that issues of health systems aren't apolitical in the way that issues of disease-focused, channeled investments can be. And Halfdan Mahler ran into trouble politically with these two documents. I've made the essential medicine ones bigger because that's really the clear health system story. The issues of the International Code of Marketing for Breast Milk Substitutes may or may not be a health systems issue, depending on how you define them. But there was, of course, a hugely contested process around the agreement of the International Code of Marketing of Breast Milk Substitutes, which was fought all the way by the corporations that made a lot of money from marketing breast milk substitutes, and it cost Mahler a lot of political capital, in particular with the US, to the point that when the essential drugs issue emerged, Mahler did not want to try and push for a code for the international marketing of pharmaceuticals, something I think is a great shame, because I think a code for the international marketing of pharmaceuticals would have hugely benefited the world if we'd managed to get something like that in place at that time, but instead focused for a more modest ambition of having a selection and use of essential medicines primarily intended for the expenditure of public resources rather than the general marketing or market for medicines. And he hoped to avoid controversy in that process. However, what in fact happened was that in 1985, the US unilaterally announced that it would only meet 20% of its obligations to the UN that had been agreed in the post-war consensus, post-war setting up of the UN. But it particularly singled out the World Health Organization to get nothing at all. So the UN generally got cut 20%, and that was the to 20%, not by 20%, to by 80%. But the World Health Organization was excluded altogether. Now, later the US said this was because of bad leadership of WHO, and that was an easy argument to make in the days of Nakajima when they started to say that was why they had singled out WHO. But of course, they did this in 1985, and Mahler had 3 years to run, and they had no... I think the world had a lot of confidence in Mahler, even if he'd run into some sticky positions with the US. So it really didn't justify that. Now, the US did that entirely extra-legally in 1985. They were legally committed to pay 100% of their dues to the UN. And in 1999, they passed the Helms-Biden Act. That's the lovely Jesse Helms in the picture there, which... made it only legal in the US to only pay a fraction of the UN dues, admittedly a larger fraction of the UN dues. They'd increased it from the 20% they were paying, and they were now operating on the basis of a ceiling of the maximum that they would pay to anyone as a proportion of its budget, any one UN organisation as a proportion of its budget. So now any American administration is either has to operate illegally from an international perspective or from a US perspective, because the two things are directly in contradiction with each other. All this down the line, of course, for WHO leads up to the budget crisis of 2011, which followed from extreme budget problems from then on in. 300 million deficit, 300 jobs cut. And that's around the point that people quote the number of 75% of WHO's money coming from project-tied funds as opposed to from general funding that would give it more authority over how it directed its operations. So it's pretty clear that in the recent period, WHO has become a huge hostage to vested interests, and that's something that serves none of us well. But it's also worth asking, you know, what else was happening in that period when primary healthcare was the official set of policies and everybody was trying to implement that. By the late 1980s, it was clear that people were retreating from that as their central position. What happened, among other things, health sector reforms that sought primarily to increase the use of market mechanisms in the context of decentralized health systems that by the early 2000s were pretty universally considered to have failed. So we've got an analysis of that failure and of the broader failure of primary healthcare as being about failures at country level, governance, and so on, and those resulted in the increasing channeling of aid through NGOs, as we saw as an alternative to directing aid through governments. The alternative or complementary analysis that the problems were at the UN level and with WHO, I think, were what drove the new partnership funding arrangements. And there are increasing demands, not just for accountability, but attribution associated with the way that richer countries' governments' politics have changed over that time. Not to mention that as 2000 approached, it's very clear that Health for All wasn't happening even in the most approximate of senses, so that's attention really needed to be directed away from that particular goal, and of course the role of HIV/AIDS lobby groups over that period as well as treatments for HIV became available. Nevertheless, it's WHO... What am I doing for time? Running out. Right. It's WHO that has continued to be the main health system supporting agency, and these are some of the things that it's been doing over the recent period. It created the building blocks methodology for thinking about health systems. Personally, I don't like it, but at least it's some thinking. They produced two World Health Reports. I can't think of any other two World Health Reports that have been produced on more or less the same subject 3 years apart, one on universal health coverage, the other one on research for universal health coverage. And Margaret Chan has made it very clear that she sort of nails her political capital to the mast of universal health coverage and is pushing it very hard. Going back to the issues of NCDs, just a quick word about how these charts work. The blues are the NCDs, the reds are the infectious diseases, the greens are accidents and injuries and so on. And the shading tells you how fast the things are growing. So pale things are declining in importance, dark things are increasing in importance over time. And that particular block, it's called a tree diagram, I believe, shows that in this region, which is Southeast Asia, East Asia, Oceania, NCDs are now overwhelmingly the most important set of health issues. So if we take that back to the trivial funding for NCDs that we saw in the map at the beginning, there's really a huge, huge mismatch there. Of course, if we think about it in terms of the poorest part of the world, sub-Saharan Africa, infectious diseases are still important, so it's not to say that global aid flows ought to only be going to NCDs, but there's clearly a mismatch in this region. Now, in 2013, after some recovery from the budget crisis of 2011, WHO shifted its budget quite considerably towards non-communicable diseases. But when you look at this paragraph from an article in Nature from June of 2013, you do have to worry at the tiny quantities we're talking about. Somebody talked yesterday about 25 million barely buying you a Sydney suburban comfortable house or something. I can't remember what exactly was being said, and I'm not very familiar with Sydney. But when you look at that in the context of the kinds of sums that WHO is cutting from here and adding to there, it's pretty pathetic, and I think it tells us something about the world of the pauper that WHO has entered. And then, of course, dealing in NCDs, again, brings you into the political arena. It's not just about eliminating cardiac problems with a new drug. We've got to address lifestyles, and lifestyles are heavily embedded in the economic interests of the rich part of the world. And what we can see in these sort of selected newspaper articles is the sugar industry going from threats to bribes in terms of trying to influence WHO's call on what their recommended sugar limit should be. WHO actually standing strong last year, announcing that the sugar intake should be less than the equivalent of a single can of Coke in a day, which the sugar industry has not liked at all. And then the final article shows that we're back to threats again. The sugar industry planning to get US money taken back out of the situation. I'm going to roll on a bit. Blair already talked a bit about Ebola. I think Ebola crystallised a number of things, but essentially it didn't really teach us anything new. It made us realise that some of our ideas, for example, about putting health systems in the too difficult box have to be revisited. But I'll skip over that because really a lot has been said about Ebola, and I doubt I can add to it very much. This is a little interesting because it shows what WHO's actual thinking was in 2013 about Ebola and why it thought it could take its money out of the crisis response. Basically, they're saying that when we have a major crisis like that, other governments will dig deep and give us money, and so we won't worry about budgeting for it ourselves, which I think is very classic pauper thinking. We'll worry about the immediate things in front of us today, and things that might happen tomorrow we'll have to ask for help with, because we're not in a position to budget for or to insure ourselves or to help insure the world effectively. So I'll just conclude with the key points that I've tried to get across, that there has been a huge growth in health-related aid funding, faster than in aid funding generally, that the US has been the major source of that, and therefore it's also been extremely influential over how it's been spent. Both new and old channels are important, and that the new modalities reflect a decreasing trust of government-to-government working and intergovernmental organisations. That we've had requirements for attribution and accountability driving a lot of the change, and that there's a lot of water under the bridge in that discussion. NCDs have been hugely neglected. Health sector support gets a fraction of the funds, although they have been growing, and it has been possible to make significant progress in health system development where it has been prioritised. So I think that really challenges the notion that health system spending needs to be a bottomless pit, that you'll never get anywhere with it. And it also shows that some governments, not all, but some governments are really recognising the political incentives in being able to offer their populations access to decent healthcare. And that seems to me to be an opportunity that could be built on. Just one very, very local example would be Joko Widodo's election in Indonesia, very much influenced by his achievements in terms of access to healthcare in Jakarta, where he was mayor of Jakarta. So what I'm going to conclude by saying is two points to take forward. I think that we really need to think about how to mix these different aid modalities better. We tend to be polarised, and I'm definitely in the health systems tribe. We ought to be pushing health system strengthening, but there will always be a strong lobby and major resources for disease-focused investments, and I think we need to be smarter about using those better instead of fighting against them. And lastly, about WHO, I think it's the only agency that's going to lead on health systems issues. WHO, the World Bank, is very tarnished by the health sector reform series of events and generally seen as representing only an economic view of the issues. As an economist, I sometimes think, well, what else is there? But of course, maybe there are a few other things that need to be taken into account. But we also need more accountability and structural reform and political reform in WHO. That's very clear, or it won't be able to do it anyway. So, thank you very much.
Barbara, thank you for that tremendously insightful kind of look from what is an old debate, as the point you've made. It's not new, despite the fact that there's always renewed interest in the different components. So that was great for me. Let's open the floor up to questions, so we can get a good debate going. Okay, here first.
Thanks very much, Barbara. It was really, really interesting. Just on the topic of NCDs, isn't that really a way, if there is some momentum towards that, to emphasise the health systems component, because primary healthcare as a whole, there are so many different NCD routes that primary healthcare systems are do you think that's one of the best routes in? Or is that dangerous because talking about NCDs is even less sexy than talking about primary healthcare systems? I'd like your views on that. And also within universal coverage, if we want to try and link health systems onto something that's getting a lot of focus, then UC might be it. But my worry is, particularly in our region, at least in Asia, that often, like in Indonesia, is translating to more hospital funding. And again, that danger for primary healthcare systems. How do we solve that primary healthcare system strengthening conundrum?
Sure, happy to do that. Ben, do you want to?
Thanks, Barbara, for being there. I suppose there's two points. Firstly, a question around making the case for investing in the health system. Particularly from a global perspective, so my experience over the last few years is that, when you talk about health systems to politicians or to general bureaucrats or general aid managers, they glaze over. And the sort of rhetoric is, this is too difficult, it's too complex, and we don't get results. And then we get diverted into sort of what I think is an artificial polarisation between research and horizontal. What's your view about how we change the debate and the rhetoric and the case for health systems, and how do we move beyond this old debate? And the second question is really a challenge about your last statement about WHO as the global leader lead with the health system strategy. I suppose I would view that yes, WHO has a role in the normative standards, but there is a very complex health architecture out there which includes finance and other political processes to drive and support developing countries. So I just wanted you to justify the WHO position further. Thanks.
Okay, and NCDs as a route into health systems, maybe, but I think there's been a lot of obfuscation about the health systems issues in relation to NCDs, because the reality is that not every country can have a state-of-the-art cancer centre. And when you start talking about NCDs in countries like Indonesia, that tends to be what everybody thinks you're talking about, is sort of high-end treatment. And it seems that nobody has been quite brave enough to say that's not what you're going to be able to have. And so it's a complicated debate, and I think where people have felt more comfortable is in the industry control, changing lifestyle element of the NCD debate, much more than the health sort of treatment and health service response to NCDs. And of course, that itself has another set of issues, as the sugar story says. So I think they're, you know, NCDs are difficult, and I think, you know, a bit like, you know, they're all the difficult things that don't get done. And I think, you know, maybe that's what the kind of crossroads that we're at. And then I think universal health coverage or universal coverage has clearly been a very popular idea in countries. Much less so than with the international actors. So WHO has pushed it. Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been absolutely clear that it's nothing to do with it, and other agencies sit somewhere in the spectrum between those things. So it has been a very interesting thing to sort of try and understand why what people's positions are, and I think it comes back to what Ben's saying about glazing over when you talk about health systems and putting it in the too difficult box. And if that is where we are, and I would accept that, I think the kind of way forward has got to be around the lessons learned from Ebola. I think it has made people wake up to an understanding that when you just ignore a festering problem because you're finding it too difficult to cope with, you know, bad things jump up at you. And while in this region and really in the world as a whole, Ebola is not the problem. Ebola has concentrated minds. In this region really ought to be worried about avian influenza, swine influenza, coronaviruses, and antimicrobial resistance as issues that are also founded on weak health systems that are going to come and bite us if we continue to just say these things are too difficult. And also I think there's strong evidence that they're not too difficult. I mean, if Thailand can do it, if Rwanda can do it, for goodness sake, other countries can do it. It doesn't have to be too difficult. And I think there's an increasing body of understanding out there about how these things can be tackled with political commitment from the countries concerned, and I think that's the key thing. So maybe part of the story is about trying to understand where that political commitment can come from. You wouldn't necessarily have seen Indonesia as being the prime ground for political commitment to universal coverage, and yet clearly that has arisen in a not particularly likely setting, and it has come through popular electoral mechanisms. So as well as others, but you know, most recently through popular electoral mechanisms. So maybe there's some scope to work with that. In relation to WHO, I take your point, the health system needs are very context specific, and therefore, you know, making global utterances about how things must be is not always helpful. But I think at big levels of generalisation they can be. So, you know, primary healthcare was useful as an idea, even if it was needed to be interpreted contextually in every place that thought about it. But the fact that you could get every single Minister of Health signing up to it in 1978 shows that it didn't need that fine graining in terms of its resonance with realities in different places. And I think universal coverage could be the same if we can support WHO to drive it.
Can I just add two other comments? Mm. I think just on that NCDs, I think we haven't actually found the way through this, but I think in addition to your comment around sensitivities, I heard yesterday conversations around community or engagement support for the broader aid program, and so the intersection of the aid program support with the funding and the priorities that we make, I think discussions around lifestyle choices is actually quite difficult to sell across Australia for investing in aid program. We haven't quite got the answer to that. I don't know what the answer is, but it's another sensitivity and difficult issue that we've got to kind of be aware of that sits behind the activities that we may support or prioritise. Just to give some confidence and support to the recognition within the government around, as you're saying, Ebola has taken. I have heard health systems in meetings with our foreign minister. She has actually, I think, more in the last 6 months as a result of Ebola, talked about health systems in meetings. She's aware of it across government more broadly, which I hadn't heard 12 months ago. Now, that's because of a whole lot of reasons. There was a lot of other issues going on 12 months ago, but I think there is a lot more, and we are sort of using that, and that's being very positive. Thirdly, just to pick up, you talked about sort of using that and other emerging infectious diseases in the region. That has been much of our thinking about the support and preparedness for the region for Ebola. It has actually been thinking about how we do this right now for Ebola, but actually we know it's these other ones. So much of the training, much of the sort of the push on equipment and preparedness has been for other diseases. So we have had that very much that sort of investment in mind. I'll go Joel here. We had one up the back, and then we'll go.
Thank you very much. I'm Joel Lang, University of Sydney. I was just hoping you would comment on how health system strengthening aid can be delivered. Because I think looking at the funding side is a little bit, because for HIV, obviously, the medicines are very expensive, for TB, the diagnostics are expensive, whereas for health system strengthening aid, it's perhaps, in some cases, more advice, guidance, thinking about a financing system, thinking about workforce training. It's not necessarily input driven, so I was hoping you could comment on what we actually need to do to provide health system strengthening aid.
Thank you, Barbara. I love the graphs you put up. The health ethics group does some wonderful work. But the more that I look at the data for individual countries, I find that there's a lot of debate about the quality of the data. And I'm just wondering whether the increase in budget is being also reflected in an increase in concern about the nature of the data that are being collected and how they're analyzed and so on. And are we moving from an evidence-based policy framework to a biased evidence policy framework?
And then one more just here.
Hi, Tony Babbis from CSIRO. I'm wondering what is the capacity to take anticipatory measures, and the issue that strikes me is agrarian change and rural to urban migration that often leads to very poor diet, poor nutrition, the double burden essentially, which will inevitably lead to poor health outcomes such as diabetes. So what's our capacity to analyse, anticipate and prevent?
Okay. I think it's a very good question. Go back to the microphone. I think it's a very good question. It is slightly different. I mean, there are obviously investments, and one of the problems with the investments is that some of those are controversial, because clearly the big gap for health systems is staff, and yet there are constraints to the way that staff can be funded through aid flows, which I frankly think are ridiculous. We're going to have to get over them, because that is the major issue, and is probably the major issue in the recent Ebola crisis, is the staff situation. If I wasn't running out of time when I got to that slide, I would have made that point, because the post-conflict situation of those three countries is not an irrelevance to what happened. And in fact, if you look at Ebola outbreaks in Africa over the last 20 years, they have tended to emerge in conflict-affected places, including northern Uganda, DRC, and so on. There are issues about why it's emerging in those countries, people's livelihoods being forced to the extremes, to the extent that they're forced to eat bat meat from parts of forests that they haven't had to access before. But it's also the case that in these three countries, Guinea, not so conflict affected, but has had a huge refugee problems from Sierra Leone and Liberia, and particularly in the region where Ebola emerged, that the health workforce issues related to post-conflict situations have been very important. So just to give an example of Sierra Leone, the concentration of health staff in Freetown and the surrounding areas in Sierra Leone is almost 100%. What there is outside Freetown is health aides, very basic health staff. And that's related to it having been, you know, completely unsafe to be trying to operate from anywhere else. And then how do you get people to go back when things improve? So there's a bit of a long answer, and probably I need to move on. But yes, it's complicated, and you know that is why it gets put in the too difficult box. It's not just a question of funding some inputs and Bob's your uncle. You've got to, you know, you've got to work at it, and it's complicated, and people don't like that. They want nice, straightforward answers. The evidence for a policy framework, I completely agree with you. We've got a lot more data, and it is dodgy. Whether that's an advance or not is questionable. I'm not an expert on all that stuff, so I won't comment further, but just to agree with you that, yes, we can put these pretty graphs up, and that's the consensus about what the state of the world is. But even the huge levels of unallocated that don't apply to this region but to some other regions tell you what some of the data quality issues are. Capacity for anticipating, I think it's really important, and I think it's one of the reasons why it's so shocking that NCDs are so neglected. Because if you anticipate just about everything that's changing, and particularly in this region, the NCD burden is already here, but it's still a fraction of its future. And the issues of diabetes related to migration are just one element of how that's happening across all kinds of issues of social change and the way that's leading to NCDs, and we are sleepwalking into having absolutely no response to that. And that's also a huge security issue, because you know when health systems are completely swamped by things they can't cope with, there's likely to be civil unrest and so on. And implications for migration as people try to get away from countries that can't deal with their health problems and so on, all of which have regional implications and all of which seem to be being ignored.
I'll just take one more, because one person is very, very keen, and then we'll...
Okay, sorry, you just couldn't see us over here all the way.
We're
a WHO collaborating centre at BTS in Sydney, but we're an incredibly rare beast because we're a nursing group. So within WHO, there's about 97% of their employees are doctors. And I guess when we look at health systems strengthening over and over again, we've been doing some great work in maternal and child health in this region, because the targets for NDG 1.5 weren't met, and finding the world won't help. If we actually increase the capacity of the educational facilities for the world, we'll start having an impact. And I really believe when Joel's asking what can we do from health system strengthening improvement, it's around empowering nursing midwifery educational institutes in the region and globally. And I just wondered if you have any comments on that. Thank you.
I think it's certainly the solutions to health workforce problems are about simplifying and changing the mix of staff. I don't think the whole solution is in nurses and midwives. I think some of it's in lower level health staff as well, but I certainly agree with you that the answer isn't in doctors.
So. Thanks, Bella. Please join with me and thank both of you.
Been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.